through the entire chapter, even though the sermon is essentially going to cover the chapter. But in a lot of ways, chapter 4 is very similar to chapter 2. Nebuchadnezzar has this disturbing dream. Daniel comes in, he interprets it, and the dream comes true. And that's essentially what happens in chapter 4. Nebuchadnezzar has this disturbing dream, calls in everyone. No one can interpret it except Daniel. Daniel interprets it for him, and then, and the part that we didn't read, a little bit down the road, all of it comes true. Nebuchadnezzar ends up wandering the fields, eating grass. He loses his kingdom, and at the end, the kingdom is restored to him, and the kingdom is even extended during the rest of his reign. So it's a very interesting passage. I was wrestling a little bit with how to handle it because, like I said, thematically it's very similar to chapter 2. But something very unique happens in chapter 4, which is this. Everything that happens in chapter 4 is designed for a purpose, and the purpose is this. God is working in such a way to bring Nebuchadnezzar low, to humble him. And so that's essentially the theme that we're going to follow through the sermon today. I don't know if you've realized this, but humility is a very interesting character quality. It's one of those things that you can work on, and you know, our society in some ways we value humility, but in some ways we don't, right? Like in some ways we like the fact that people are humble or that they don't boast about themselves. In other scenarios, we love when people boast about themselves. You know, football seems to be more interesting when there's, you know, celebrations and people point at themselves. At the same time, if it's too much, then it kind of turns us off. We like it to some degree. We like when people are when it makes them fun and interesting. It's not as fun when you have a coworker who all he does is talk about himself. You know, it's a very, like, fine line. In addition, humility is a very interesting quality because you can work on it and work on it. The minute you think you have it, you don't, right? I mean, that's kind of the way humility works. The minute you say that you're humble, you're no longer humble anymore. And no other character quality works like that. Humility is the one that the moment you think you have it, it's definitely not true then. So it's a very elusive quality. And so here we have King Nebuchadnezzar, who is the king of Babylon, which is one of the two world powers at the time. It's Babylon and Medes that essentially own the entire world outside of these little pieces. And King Nebuchadnezzar essentially, as far as he can see, he goes out and he looks and everything is his. He has conquered Israel and he owns a large swath of land. And basically, in chapter 4, God decides to take him down a peg. And there's spiritual reasons for that, and we'll get into the spiritual reasons. But basically today, as we go through Daniel chapter 4, as we track through humility, I want to show you three things. First thing I think we see is we see why God humbles. And that's true not only for Nebuchadnezzar, it's also true for us. You know, why God humbles, why he brings people low at times. Second thing we see is how God humbles. There's a way in which God works in Nebuchadnezzar's life, and there's a way in which he works in our lives to humble us, to bring us low. And the third thing that I want to show you in chapter 4 is what God does for the humble. Okay? So first, why God humbles. Second, how God humbles. Third, what he does for the humble. So first, why God humbles. If you go into verses 28 and 30, let me read it for you again. Actually, this wasn't a part of the reading. You know, if I had Joel actually read the entire chapter the way that it's all kind of put together, he probably would have had to do the entire thing speed reading the way he did little parts. But it's a really long passage. But verse 28, right where he stopped at 27, 28, we see that what is prophesied or what's dreamt about actually happens. And here's what happens. Verse 28, it says, all this came upon King Nebuchadnezzar. So all the stuff that he had been dreaming finally happens. It says, at the end of the 12 months, he was walking on the roof of the royal palace of Babylon, and the king answered and said, is not this great Babylon, which I have built by my mighty power as a royal residence for the glory of my majesty? While the words were still in the king's mouth, there fell a voice from heaven, O King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is spoken, the kingdom has departed from you. So if you notice, this is a little ways out after he's had the dream, and the dream finally comes true. But I want you to notice something. I want you to notice the words that King Nebuchadnezzar speaks. You know, again, we don't know the exact timing of it. It's about a year later, but he's out on his rooftop, and he's surveying everything that he can see. And if you listen to his words, he says this. He says, "Is not this great Babylon, which I have built by my mighty power as a royal residence and for the glory of my majesty?" So basically he's saying, I am the reason why all of this is. I am the reason why I have what I have. I am the reason why things are the way that they are. And all of it is for my glory. All of it shows people how great I am. Hopefully that's not a thought you've ever had in your life. But, you know, what we see is we see a man who has this incredibly warped view of life and of reality. You know, we have this person who thinks that everything in his kingdom, his accomplishments, his position, everything that he sees in front of him is attributed to him. That it's because of his intelligence, his cunning, his leadership, his strength and might, his wisdom. He thinks all of it is attributed to himself, but we know that that's not true. You know, it's one of those pitfalls. I think you and I fall into that, but in minor ways, not in this King Nebuchadnezzar way, but we get to stages in our lives where we think that essentially what we have and who we are is because of us. We attribute it to our hard work. We attribute it to the ways in which we've been cunning and crafting. We attribute it to things about us that are very controlled, our intellect, our intelligence, our foresight, our wisdom. And the fact of the matter is, I hate to kind of break the warped reality that you live in, but it never is. Whether we're rich or whether we're poor, it's never entirely because of us. You know, there are so many factors, there are so many pieces, so many things that contribute to our success, to our prosperity, to our place in life, that it's hubris, it's pure pride to say that it's purely because of me. So for instance, just to list out a couple of different parts that contribute to it, depending on what you do, I mean, genetics play a huge part in what we're able to accomplish, what we do accomplish. I remember I think I've mentioned this before, but a model, I don't remember who it was. I never know who models are and, you know, how popular they are. But this model came out, she was talking with some school-age girls, and one of the questions she got was, how can I grow up to be like you? You know, how can I prepare myself? How can I become a model? And this model is very honest. She said, it's genetic lottery. You know, it's out of your control. You know, to some degree, there's a sense in which, you know, for her line of work, it is complete just genetics. It's how you look, and it's what at that period of time is in. And those are things that to some degree we have a little bit of control over, but we don't have complete control over that. You know, when you move out of the model, you could say, of course, that's about physical appearance, that's about, you know, beauty, of course, that's out of your control. Our intelligence is out of our control. You know, the fact that we have an intellect to whatever capacity that we have it, you know, that's genetic. We didn't, you know, as little kids, we didn't say, you know, I would really like to be super intelligent when I grow up, enough to be able to do this and this and this. None of that's under our control. Has to do with your parents. It has to do with, again, a genetic lottery that could be beyond, you know, what your parents give you. It could be, you know, all those complete things out of your control. And then you look into athletics or you look into other areas, and there's issues of strength and skill that are simply issues of genetics. There are some people who can make themselves into world-class athletes through sheer will that don't have the genetics, but it's incredibly hard. You know, usually professional athletes will tell you that they will admit that there is some level of genetics involved in that. That to some degree, yes, it was hard work. Yes, it was diligent study. Yes, it was work. But to some degree, there are certain characteristics and qualities that were already there that they had to continue to develop. There were things that were there that maybe someone else doesn't have that allows them to do the things that they do. That no one can just get up and say, you know what, I'm going to put in the work and I'm going to be that. And when you get beyond the genetics component, you know, when you look at even simply the fact of when and where we're born, that plays a huge part in what we become. You know, for instance, you can take someone like Bill Gates, and my bet is if Bill Gates was born in a small little village in Mongolia, he wouldn't be the second richest man in the world. He could be just as intelligent. You know, he could be someone who makes a way for himself and his life in Mongolia, but he wouldn't be what he is. And again, that's completely out of your control. You know, where you're born plays a huge role in the opportunities you have and the ways that your life progresses. And when you're born makes a huge difference too, doesn't it? Not just where, but when. You're born 50 years earlier, 100 years earlier, 300 years earlier. I mean, those are very vastly different things. Now, if you're a woman and you're born 500 years ago, your experience in society is much different than today. You know, today, you know, there's opportunities that you're afforded. There's avenues that are open that were previously closed, even 100 years ago. And none of those things are things that we have made decisions on, that we have chosen, that we have said, you know, this is what I want things to be so that I can become who I am going to become. And even beyond that, there's environment. There's the setting that we're placed, the way in which we're raised. And of course, we can go against certain things. It's not that everything is determinative. But there's a lot of there's a strong sense in which the environment that we're brought into shapes us, the way in which we're raised. Matter of fact, I heard this very, very interesting. I was looking it up, trying to figure out where I heard it or who I'd heard it from, and I couldn't track it down. But I was listening to someone, and they were saying how there's this brand new program that they were testing out in some particular inner city, and what they did was they would take kids from the public school, kind of different races, and they would take them out to the track, and they would line them up at the start line, and essentially they would begin to ask them questions. They would say, for instance, they would say, if you live in a two-parent home, then take, you know, a couple steps forward. Right? And so you'd have a couple kids who, you know, who take a few steps forward, and they would say, okay, well, if you've never had to worry about food in your life, about where the next meal is coming from, then take, you know, take a step forward. If you've never worried about, you know, about your physical welfare in your neighborhood, then, you know, take a few more steps forward. And, you know, they asked a lot of questions like that. And at the end, what they did was they said, take a look back at where you are. You know, look at where you are in relation to everyone else. And essentially the lesson was, all of us run the same race, but some of us do start farther behind than others. And again, that's not to say that you can't catch up. That's not to say that you can't overcome certain things. But there are a lot of things that are out of our control that contribute to our success, to our prosperity, to where we are later in life, that it's not simply hard work. It's not simply, you know, the sheer force or the cunningness that I have in my own self. Matter of fact, even when you look at opportunities, there are some people who are afforded opportunities that you and I would never have, even if we're the same intelligence level, you know, same degree, same experience, because of friends. Some people receive opportunities because of the school they went to. They have a certain friend, and because of this friend, it opens certain doors that lead to other opportunities that you and I might never have. And the truth is, and again, this can be something that you work out not believing in a God at all. If you're honest about it, there is a lot about your success, your prosperity, who you are, where you are in life, that don't have as much to do with you as you think. And yet, you know, what we see in Nebuchadnezzar is he makes this statement where he thinks that he is the reason why everything is the way that it is. He thinks he's the reason why he has the success, the prosperity, and the peace that he enjoys. And that's never true for any of us. It's never true for any of us. Matter of fact, I bet you could go back into you can go to Nebuchadnezzar's life, and I bet you could figure out that that his father was king, that there were a lot of things that afforded him, and that because of that, it afforded him an education, it afforded him a place, it afforded him a position, And obviously, when his father passed away, it afforded him the best opportunity. And he might not have been the best person in the kingdom. Might not have even been the best person in the court. And you see, the reason why God humbles him is because he has this completely warped view of reality. And for you and I, you know, if we're not careful, we can fall into the very same thinking, you know, that our wealth, our prosperity, our position, our reputation, that all those things are simply because of us. And when we think that way, we've warped reality. I'll tell you why it's really dangerous, and the real reason why God is actually why God is in the process of humbling him. And I think this is the exact same reason why God humbles us. I think a lot of times when we hear this and when we see this, it looks like God being vengeful or God meting out some type of punishment or that type of thing. God humbling Nebuchadnezzar, God humbling you and I is actually an act of grace. And the reason why I say that is this. When you live with a warped view of reality where you are the reason for everything good in your life, eventually what that does, what that belief does, what that warped sense of life and reality does is it eventually leads you to hatred. And I know you don't make those connections, but if you think like Nebuchadnezzar thinks, if you think like you and I from time to time think, that path actually leads you to ultimate hatred. If you play it out, it makes sense. First of all, it leads you to hatred for God. You know, if you think that you are the source and the cause of everything in your life, that you're the reason why you have what you have, why you don't have what you don't have, then you begin to leave God out of your life. He's not important. You don't need him. And you could say, but Pastor Young, that isn't hatred. You know, that's just kind of neutrality towards God. Well, the Bible says that God has created us, and so basically anything outside of total allegiance is hatred. That when you and I discount God, when you and I push God aside, when you and I say that God really isn't necessary, when we stop relying on God, it is utter hatred. And the reason why is because we believe in our hearts that we no longer need him. And when we no longer need him, we no longer want him. That's one of the ways that hatred plays out. You know, when you believe that you're the source and the reason for everything in your life, then eventually you grow this hatred towards God. The other thing that happens is you begin to hate other people too. And here's how that works. If you think that you're the reason why you are, where you are, who you are, how you are, then anyone who has not made it to where you are, you despise and you look down on. Right? You look at them, you say, oh, they're so lazy. If they just pulled themselves up by their own bootstraps, if they just applied themselves a little bit more, there's something wrong with them, right? And in your heart, you begin to despise them. The funny thing is, it happens on the other end too. The people who are above you who have more, if you're the reason why you are where you are and have what you have, then when you see people who have more, you begin to hate them too because they're better than you, right? If what you have and who you are is because of you, then if someone has more, if someone is better, then it means that they are better people than you. And all of a sudden, when you look at what you have, when you look at what they have, it doesn't just cause jealousy, it causes hatred. And you know, that's the amazing thing, is when we ask ourselves, why does God humble? Sure, there's a sense in which God humbles because there's sin involved and there's, you know, things that don't please him. But in another way, God humbles because he loves. It's a gracious way in which he is protecting us, he is challenging us, and he is steering us out of that utter hatred, hatred for God, hatred for other people that would grow if we think that we are the reason for everything that we have. But that's the first thing we see, is we see why God humbles. He humbles because to live life that way distorts us. Not only do we distort reality, we change, and it turns us into people who hate God, hate other people. Second thing we see is we see how God humbles. And this is very straightforward. Go into verses 4 and 5, and we see it says, I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at ease in my house and prospering in my palace. I saw a dream that made me afraid. As I laid in bed, the fancies and the visions of my head alarmed me. Now, I want you to go to verse 28 again. I'm going to read down to 32, and I want you to listen to when it actually takes place. That was when the vision comes to him. This is when it actually kind of falls on him, but it says again, all this came upon King Nebuchadnezzar. At the end of the 12 months, he was walking on the roof of the royal palace of Babylon, and the king answered and said, is not this great Babylon, which I have built by my mighty power as a royal residence and for the glory of my majesty? While the words were still in the king's mouth, there fell a voice from heaven, O King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is spoken, the kingdom has departed from you, and you shall be driven from among men, and your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field, and you shall be made to eat grass like an ox, and 7 periods of time shall pass over you, until you know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom he will. So basically we see that in this first, you know, verse 4 and 5, the dream comes upon him when he's simply enjoying his prosperity. He's living a life of ease, he's enjoying his wealth, he's enjoying all the material things that he has, and, you know, God comes in and he gives him this strange vision. When it actually takes place, again, Nebuchadnezzar's out on the palace, and he's enjoying the fruits of his prosperity. He's enjoying all that he sees. He's thinking about how wonderful and how great he is, and bam, you know, voice comes down, and next thing he knows, he's living out in the field, no shelter, eating the grass. You know, in both cases, what we see is we see God interrupts him. You know, he interrupts him with a strange vision. He interrupts him with a strange voice. And basically, in these two different sections, we see the exact same pattern. God steps into Nebuchadnezzar's moments of ease and enjoyment, and he essentially shakes up his life. And you know, that's exactly how God deals with us when God humbles us. God steps in a time where things are relatively quiet, when we're enjoying our ease and our prosperity, and we're not really thinking about God or about deeper things. And what he does is he comes in and he shakes things up. And it's very, very effective. Sometimes God actively does something. Sometimes God takes something that's happening and he uses it that way. But it's very, very effective. We go from quietness, we go from ease, to all of a sudden there's a problem, there's a challenge, there is something that's happening in our lives that now throws everything into upheaval. And you know, those can be different things. For instance, you know, sometimes God uses our own health. You know, something happens to our bodies. We get a diagnosis or something starts breaking down, and God means for it to humble us. For others, it's finances. All of a sudden we go from being, you know, fat and happy to all of a sudden something's happening financially in our lives. And it causes us to question it. It shakes up our lives. It makes things different. For others, it's relationships. We're going along smooth and easy. Things seem to be good. You know, friendships seem to be strong. Life is happening. And all of a sudden, relationships are shaken up. And you know, for Nebuchadnezzar, what we see is we see this intense change in his life. And the intense change happens because he experiences essentially this psychological problem, this psychological break. He goes from peace and ease, enjoying his prosperity, to having some kind of mental break with reality where he's now living outdoors like a beast. And it sounds like a strange thing. As I was reading about this passage and reading some commentaries, I started reading about the fact that there is actually a psychological condition called boanthropy. And it's this condition that it's not seen very often, but if you look it up on the internet, there's pictures of people doing this, but you know, there's this kind of break that happens sometimes for people with a reality where they think that they're cows. And I know that's a strange thing to think, but they begin to act like cows. So they essentially go outside and they wander, they begin to graze on the grass. And it's actually a condition. Matter of fact, one of the commentators that I read said that one of the things that he actually got to see as a pastor is he got to see someone who was suffering from boanthropy. So he went to this mental institution, and this man who was suffering from it, and This man wouldn't talk to anyone. If he wasn't in the institution, he wouldn't wear clothes. He'd go outside, and essentially he would sit off by himself. Sometimes he would crawl around. Sometimes he would just kind of stand, and he would just stare out into nothing. And then once in a while, he would bend down, or he would grab some grass, and he would chew it. Wouldn't eat any food besides that. And he genuinely lived like a cow. He thought he was a cow. Matter of fact, it was so serious, it was so consuming, that the staff had to go out and they had to put containers out with water in it. Otherwise, he would go to the mud puddles and he would begin to drink water from them. So they'd have to put these containers out so that he would at least be drinking clean water. And so there's some break in reality that happens to Nebuchadnezzar. And if you notice, there's this pattern. You know, God uses disruptions. Again, whether it's something that he forcefully brings into life, or whether it's something where it's simply the fact that we live in a broken world, the tragedies and the sufferings of life, you know, God takes those and he uses them to shake us up. And you know, when that happens, all of us have been through that. Life is going along easy and nice and smooth, and things seem to be, and all of a sudden something breaks. And immediately when that happens, when something shifts, when something changes, you know, we feel things. We feel fear. We feel helplessness. We feel all alone. And the reason why we feel those is God sets things up so that those things are meant to drive us back to God, to show us that life is uncontrollable. To show us at the height of the moments where we say, everything I have, everything I am, everything I will be is because of me, God says, no, it isn't. That's a very painful message. In an instant, we realize that we're not who we think we are. And if we take the lesson well, if we understand it the way God wants us to understand it, it actually drives us back to God, not away from God. And it reminds us that God is the reason why we are who we are, why we have what we have, and why we will be what we will be. In other words, it shifts reality back to true reality for us. And the way God does it is he waits until there's moments where we feel completely at ease, completely peaceful, and he twists it. And it's very powerful when he does that. Again, you know, I've been through that a couple different times, and I'm sure you have, and they're always designed to drive us back to God. The bigger the disruption, the more power, the greater it affects us. You know, and so here you have Nebuchadnezzar, who the most important thing in his life is disrupted. He lives on ease, he lives on prosperity, and all of that is completely stripped away. God tends to do that. He tends to take the area that we are, that we love the most, we desire the most, and that's the part that at different moments in life we feel slipping away. For Nebuchadnezzar, God takes all of it away, and it changes him. You can make an argument about how much he changes, because there's another problem in his life, the next chapter, but to some degree it does change him. But that's how God works in his life. God waits until you're, you know, fat and happy and not thinking about things, where, you know, you're living in ease, and then he changes one thing, and that change changes everything. At least it's supposed to. Last thing I wanted to address is this, is what God does for the humble. Let's go to verses 34 through 37. And again, this is a part we didn't read, but this is the way the story wraps up. Nebuchadnezzar has this dream, and then all of it comes true. So he's out eating grass, kind of living like a beast of the field. And then we find the end of the story. And the end of the story says this. Verse 34 says, at the end of the days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted up my eyes to heaven, and my reason returned to me. And I blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing, and he does according to his will among the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth, and none can stay his hand or say to him, what have you done? At the same time, my reason returned to me, and for the glory of my kingdom, my majesty and splendor returned to me. My counselors and my lords sought me, and I was established in my kingdom, and still more greatness was added to me. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, for all his works are right, and his ways are just. And those who walk in pride, he is able to humble. I want you to notice what the story is about. Nebuchadnezzar, at this point, he's lost everything, but he recovers everything. And matter of fact, we find out at the end that his kingdom actually grows afterward. You know, God humbles and then God restores. And that's not by accident. Ultimately, the story is not about how God can take things away and how God powerfully looks down and sees and says, you're not all that, and strips it off. The story is ultimately about God, about the fact that God, restores. The story is about the fact that God forgives. The story is about the fact that all those things are true, not just in a physical way, but also in a spiritual way. And the story is about the fact that Nebuchadnezzar is humbled, and because he's humbled, God then acts differently towards him. You know, it's interesting because, you know, that could make it seem like humility is a prerequisite for God doing certain things. And to some degree it is, but it's not as if humility earns these things that God does. Matter of fact, in James, one of the things we find out is he says, God gives grace to the humble. Now, if you listen to that carefully, James is not saying that if you're humble, then God will give you something, and the thing that he gives you will be earned because of your humility. It's telling us that God has a certain disposition towards humility. That's a very important distinction to make. It's not that if we're humble, then God will bless us with things that we say we don't need and that type of thing. But it tells us that God has a unique relationship, a unique way of dealing with humility. It's almost as if God has this reflex that when he sees humility, he deals well with it. You know, we find that out in the Proverbs. Again, you know, like I said, James tells us that God gives grace to the humble. And in some ways, it's humility that draws God out. You could make the case that in some ways God notices. I don't know, again, theologically, how you kind of parse that up. But the Bible is clear that God sees, he sees the humble, he sees the meek. He desires to bless them. He desires to pour grace upon them. And you know, the thing that I want to end with is this. I think the thing that we end with is why. Why does God respond that way to humility? Why does he love those who are humble? Why does he love the meek? Now turn to Philippians 2:5, and I think we find our answer. In Philippians 2, we're given this wonderful, wonderful statement about Jesus. And I think it begins to answer the question for us. In Philippians 2, verse 5, speaking of Jesus, Paul is commanding us. He says, have this mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus. And the rest of it is about Jesus. It says, who though he, Jesus, was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but made himself nothing, taking the form of a servant. Being born in the likeness of men and being found in human form, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. Therefore, God has highly exalted him and bestowed on him the name that is above every name, so that at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. I think what Philippians 2 tells us is it tells us the reason why God has a disposition towards humility. It's because God has designed humility to be the way through which proud sinners like us are rescued from our sin. It's the mode and the method through which the Son of God would come, through which he would lay down his life, give his life for those who do not deserve it. And it's the mode through which you and I see the Savior's love. And I think that's one of the reasons why God has this disposition. And I think what Paul is reminding us of, or showing us, or teaching us of in Philippians, is that the real place that comes from, the real place that humility comes from, is from first seeing what Jesus has done for us. When you see what Jesus has done for you, there is nothing left to be proud of at all. You could go from first saying, everything in my life, everything I am, everything I ever will be because of me. And the moment you step before in front of the cross, all of that is shattered. You begin to see that you could not save yourself, that you are someone who is lost, desperately lost, hopeless, drowning in your sin. And yet Jesus came to rescue you. Not with a puffed out chest saying, your Savior is here, the hero has arrived, but in humility. And in humility, when you see his humility, then that's what makes us humble too. As we get ready to take the Lord's Supper together, there's a sense in which, again, you know, for you and I, we can imagine that we are the reason why we are where we are, why we are who we are. But when we stand before Christ spiritually,